Hello and welcome to this segment of Two Worlds, One Country, the podcast where we explore the underlying causes of the rural-urban divide and other things that divide us. And then we talk to folks who've looked into it in depth, analyzed it, researched it, and are trying to do something about it. I'm your host, Anthony Flaccavento. I am a co-founder of the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, and I'm really delighted today to have as my guest, Rhys Peck. Rhys and I met just a few months ago. He is a scholar, a professor at the College of Staten Island, has also taught in the grad school at the City University of New York, and his studies, his research, and his teaching are focused on journalism, on political communication, and popular culture. Now, a lot of what we'll be talking about with Rhys today comes from a book he had published about 5 years ago called Fox Populism, Branding Conservatism as Working Class. I read it in the last month, and it is amazing. So I want to welcome Rhys to our program today, and I'm so excited to talk about your book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Rhys, you and I met at a gathering hosted by Joan Williams, who has also been on the show, that was exploring the what Joan calls the diploma divide. And I know that when you talk about some of your findings from your research into Fox News and other media, there will be some overlap there. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born and raised, kind of what brought you to where you are today.
Yeah, well, my own trajectory is kind of fits with the theme of the diploma divide. You know, I'm a first generation college graduate. My dad's an electrician. My grandpa's a bricklayer. I grew up in Utah in a very blue collar world where, you know, it wasn't so much about academics as like in my family, it was music, country music. It was sports, particularly wrestling. So that's the kind of milieu that I grew up in. And I didn't. And also, I kind of grappled with the Mormon or the LDS versus non-LDS part growing up in Utah. You know, my family was divorced, so I have an interesting kind of religious background as well. But, you know, if you met me in high school, people that know me from Utah, they wouldn't think I was going to be a professor, you know, and I probably would have thought the same.
Yeah.
Later in life, you do little baby steps, community college. Next thing you know, they pique your interest. When I wasn't kind of interested in academic work in high school. And then next thing I know, I'm in a PhD program at UCSD. And now this is the world I live in. But I do remember like being more of a blue collar kid from a kind of Mountain West state. The cognitive dissonance or the cultural awkwardness of going into, academia and higher ed, that it really is a very specific class culture that you have to adapt to. And it makes you aware of kind of much more about your own background.
And that was the case for you even at the community college level, or more so when you got into a four-year program?
Yeah, I don't even think it community college. I noticed a little bit when I shifted to a four-year program, but it really stood out in graduate school. I mean, I think graduate school, a PhD program, you know, at University of California, San Diego, that's when it was the most, I guess, stark and potent of a difference to me. But I did notice a little bit at the four-year, when I shifted to a four-year college.
Yeah, not a lot of sons or daughters of bricklayers or electricians or farmers in that PhD program?
Yeah, to say the least. And I have some funny stories, but
I bet.
We'll get into that later. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, and good on you for that, because I think so many working class kids who might want to go to college either are intimidated by the process to get there or think they'd be so out of their element, and you weathered all that. So let's jump into your book, Fox Populism, Branding Conservatism as Working Class. I found it just absolutely stunning in how you went about it and some of your findings. Let's begin with the how you went about it. Like, you spent a lot of time watching Fox News. So tell us the methodology. How did you gather your information?
It's a textual analysis study, if you want to use like the proper term. But
what does that mean? Can you say what that means?
So there's, in the social sciences, there's quantitative approaches to media,
right?
And then there's qualitative. So you think of quantitative is like the big picture, the big trends, and qualitative is more like a deep analysis of the television show. Like you look at the aesthetics, you look at the language, you look at the narratives, quantitative is kind of, you're looking at like broader trends. You're not digging into the text as much.
Okay.
I really wanted to dive into Fox News. I didn't just want to show, they use these words over time. And, I really wanted to like understand the network from like a viewer's point of view or a Fox fan's mm-hmm. point of view. And the only way you can do that is to watch it. You have to sit there. You can't take curated clips from the Daily Show like most liberals, you can't look on YouTube, you have to sit down and watch hours and hours of Bill O'Reilly, which in my case, and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck at the time when he was kind of at his peak during the Tea Party era. So I sat there and I watched Fox News. I found an archive of cable news that was very unique and rare. It kind of still is at UCLA. And my first step was just to let it wash over me. Don't mm-hmm. try to impose what I think my hunches about it. I grew up around Fox News growing up in Utah. It wasn't like I've never seen Fox News, but I really wanted to not impose my own categories or my own assumptions I had about it. And then I started taking notes and I started saying, oh, I hear this word a lot, or I hear this narrative a lot. And then I went back after watching it for about a year straight. I then found, used transcript databases like Factiva and LexisNexis to really kind of tighten the analysis and make it more systematic. So I gathered transcripts of the broadcast and I dove into the language rather than just watching it. I'm kind of looking at word frequencies. And I started to become familiar with the special vocabulary of Fox News, right? Mm-hmm. The special kind of language world of Fox News. And it allowed me to kind of unpack, what do they mean when they say the elites? What do they mean when they say ordinary people? What do they mean when they say blue collar or the heartland? There's so many. And what I discovered in taking this approach, which few have ever done to Fox News, is that the language of conservative politics is much more layered and complicated than I think a liberal may otherwise think. Right. I think the kind of stereotype is they're stupid, or that right. or that the programming is simple and the programming is predictable. But I think when you do a deep dive into the actual political language of your opponent, you find out it's much more sophisticated and subtle than you possibly thought before.
Yeah, yeah. And that's exactly what I want to get into, that those subtleties, those layers, because that's what I found so fascinating. I have one more kind of context question before we get into the heart of it, which is something I knew zero about, which is how Fox kind of is a part of a history or has part of the lineage of a certain kind of journalism. And in your first chapter or two, you discuss how historically in the United States, there was like tabloid journalism that emerged at one point. And then there was this more highbrow sort of, or at least ostensibly a professional and more objective journalism. And you don't have time on the show right now to go too deep, but just talk about what are those distinctions and how those distinctions and tabloid journalism in particular kind of paved the way and also helped to sort viewers to some degree by class.
Yeah. So the history of American journalism is largely a story of class markets, class-based readerships, right? So you look at the penny press in the 1830s, and even from the beginning of the commercial news industry, you already see this class polarization between this kind of quality press, the prestige press, and then the tabloid or popular press. So there's always been class at the center of journalism, right? Whether a lot of people forget this, right?
Okay, yeah, like
now,
me.
It, the, Yeah, but the for the most of American history, while Americans have always had tablet journalism, you know, the supermarket checkout aisle with UFO sightings and Elvis sightings and love triangles with celebrities, we all know that that's trashy. That's not supposed to be like highbrow or good educated content for us, right?
Right.
But what Rupert Murdoch did, coming from Australia and coming from the UK, was to look at that landscape. So we had these class-based news markets already established, but they didn't have a political edge to them. What he did was inject partisanship into that, right? Mm. So he said, if you like that tabloid style and you consider yourself kind of more working class, then you're conservative, right? So he took this existing class dimension that had no political edges and partisanized it. He made it a left-right thing. And so he took these long-term stories in the tabloid press about, you know, the mainstream press looks down at us, they're elitist, right? We actually represent working class people or regular people. And then he used that existing kind of narrative that was already there and made it into a political narrative, right? But there's more than that. You know, there's elements of the tabloid press that he brought to American television. I really focus on A Current Affair with Mari Povich.
Right.
But that is a show that doesn't get enough historical importance, because I really do think it's the predecessor to Fox News. But it started off as apolitical. It was mainly, you know, sensational stories about killer dolphins and the preppy killer in Central Park and things like that. But it was Murdoch kind of honing his ability to really adapt the partisan press of the UK, which is both tabloid and political. So that back there, it's always been both tabloid and partisan. And he wanted to pull off this mixture in the United States. And really with Fox News, he achieves that goal.
That's so interesting. Yeah, Mari Povich. And you talk about some of the others in that line as well. So when that happened, there was is it safe to say that at the time that Murdoch did it, the readership was already somewhat divided along class, or did politicizing the tabloid form kind of cement the popularity with working class and push away the educated professional class?
Oh, that's such a good question, like a chicken or the egg kind
right,
of question.
Right.
I think that, you know, what I think is one of the most interesting anecdotes about Murdoch is that his first attempt to try, when he tried this tabloid partisan mixture that he took from the UK that he learned really to master there, mm-hmm. and his first attempt was the New York Post. That was because he was a print guy. He was not a TV guy. He mm-hmm. was, you know, print is king in the UK and mm-hmm. in Australia. And he was so frustrated initially in the 70s and 80s that the New York City readership was not taking to his sexy, racy, you know, New York Post. And he had a famous quote where he said, you know, the problem with the new world versus the old world, like, you know, Europe versus United right. States, is that people don't know their class station here. They have this self-improvement ethic. In other words, like, people are middle brow, or even if you're working class, you don't think of yourself as working class, right? So you don't like that tabloid style. So it wasn't as if it worked automatically, right? Mm-hmm. Or right mm-hmm. away, he was able to pull this off. It was only when he realized the real game in town in America is not print news, it's television.
Yeah.
And I need to conquer television if I'm going to have real influence. And I think that, you know, while I criticize pretty much every policy he's ever supported and and his ideology, I'm very critical of it. One thing I give Murdoch credit for is recognizing that there was a need, or there was a vacuum for a working class news style that wasn't being met, or that demand was there. People were sick of this overly polished, kind of seemingly contrived or fake style, and they were hungry for a new style of news that kind of embraced a working class voice. Now, we could say it's a puppeted one or manufactured in some type of way, but still a style that gestures toward that. And you could have imagined that maybe a liberal or progressive entrepreneur could have tapped that same market with a totally different set of ideologies, but it was the conservative in Rupert Murdoch that did it first.
Yeah.
He really broke that middle brow mold in America that everyone was used to at that point.
Right. Wow, fascinating. So let's move into the sort of heart of the book, the con- the insights about these layers you mentioned earlier. So, you know, from my point of view, we do Rural Urban Bridge Initiative does, you know, tons of trainings, and we get into the origins of the rural-urban divide. We have speakers in our regular speaker series, which, by the way, I want you to be one of them. What almost without fail, when I'm working with a group of usually liberals, progressives, Democrats, somebody will say, yeah, but what about Fox News? I understand what you're saying about the economic and the cultural and the other things. I get all that. But isn't Fox News the real problem, or Fox, et cetera, Breitbart, all of them? Because they're poisoning the minds of these people who are low information voters, who just don't have the education or the sophistication to sort through what's real and what's false. And that's kind of an incredibly common point of view on the left. And yet, even though I do think Fox has been a very destructive influence in our country in so many respects, what you show is that Fox has created, Fox might do its share of misinformation and poisoning, but you show that their approach is much more about creating a space where working class people feel valued and affirmed. So tell us about that. Take a little time to tease out both about how that's the case, but also maybe some of the examples. Your book is chock full of particular examples about this.
Yeah, so, you know, news itself, well, it used to be a kind of rarefied place that only political elites and professors and business titans were ever allowed to kind of, you know, occupy that pedestal. And so it already comes with news itself, as opposed to other forms of entertainment or other media. It comes with this seriousness, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for so long, you know, you wouldn't ever see anyone gesturing toward working class knowledge or working class kind of experiences in the news, right? The closest thing you get was like a man on the street interview or right. something like that, right?
If I can just interject, the man on the street interview from the point of the modern left, The Daily Show, Colbert, et cetera, is usually to make fun of the man on the, on the street, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry for that, but that just hit me.
They're not approaching them because they see them as valuable sources of knowledge or some, you know, point of view that's worthy of analysis.
Right.
So I think what Fox did, it basically said, hey, we're going to honor your taste that you like country music or you're a gun owner or, you know, sports culture. We value your tastes. We understand the cultural world you live in, and we value your brain and your knowledge. And we're going to treat you like you may not have, you know, credentials, and you may not, have this like pedigree, educational pedigree, but we know that you have common sense, and we know that you can still analyze the world, and you have thoughts about the world, and we're going to give you a place in the story of American politics. Like, you are part of the unfolding of American politics. And what they did is they hired anchors that were kind of like liaisons to this elite world, like they're blue collar anchors, right? So Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes consciously and intentionally recruited talent from outside the prestige sectors of the journalism field. So not from network news, not from Boston Globe or the Washington Post or New York Times. They took them from tabloid TV, Inside Edition with Bill O'Reilly, talk radio with Sean Hannity in Atlanta, Shep Smith, right, also from Inside Edition, tabloid TV, or a current affair, I mean. And so what this did is it presented a new kind of anchor, a new kind of news personality that was like, I am a welcoming entry point into this elite world of politics. Like, And that's one thing I really want to make clear to people. So an example I have for in the book, whenever they have elite guests on, like, you know, historians, they'll have their own conservative intellectuals. This is one people don't realize about Fox. It's not just, you know, these like populist anchors. They have their own researchers on. So one example, Sean Hannity was interviewing an economic historian named Amity Schles about the history of the Great Depression and FDR. And the way that Hannity started the conversation was to tell a story about his parents. He said, my parents had told me all about the Great Recession. They lived it. They went through it. And in kind of, you're like, well, what does that have to do? That's not facts. That's not policy. But it gave Hannity a kind of a reason or his own kind of type of authority to start a conversation in the face of this academic, right? And so everyone has, that's a type of knowledge that's democratic. Everyone has experiences. Everyone gains knowledge from their grandparents or from their parents, right?
And
that is not a scarce.
Exactly. Yeah, and from my own experience with, you know, myself, the way I see the world, but particularly with the farmers and coal miners and others that I've worked with for 40-ish years, you know, that is a key part of almost any conversation of substance, is their own experience. Some of it's going back to, you know, parents and grandparents, some of it's current, but their own experience is usually the starting point. And it is in a way for liberals and progressives too, but we sort of have a bias away from our own experience, thinking that our own experience is just what it is and we need to abstract above and beyond it. But for a whole lot of working folks, that is the foundation.
100%. And that's what Fox News does so well, is that their anchors will couch every story in relation to people they know in their life, right? So if there's a fishing crisis off the coast, Hannity will say, oh, I know these guys that do crab work in Long Island, New York, and I feel for those workers. And, you know, so they're always constantly framing everything in terms of their social universe,
right?
And that's how regular people actually talk about things. And I think you're 100% right, where liberal news and liberals by extension, we kind of want to emulate this idea that we're social scientists, or mm-hmm. that we want to approximate the expert voice that that takes you out of the story, right? Where conservatives are always putting their own identity in the story or their own lived experience in the story. This kind of social situating that their news anchors do that is very, it's a form of identification. It allows the audience to say that I see myself in that. But then they steer it in a very ideological direction, right? They steer these performative techniques on air in a very ideological direction.
Right. And the language. I want you to talk about the language they use. And as a kind of intro to that, talk about O'Reilly, because of all the hosts that your book was written at a time frame where Tucker Carlson had not yet risen to the prominence that he had for a number of years.
Right.
He's kind of a footnote towards the end of that period. But it was O'Reilly, right. Beck, and Hannity who were the big ones. And O'Reilly, of all of them, seems sort of the least down to earth, the most. He loves a good fight, literally and figuratively. But outside of that, he seems the most elite. So how did a guy like O'Reilly either transition or make himself out to be working class, including language?
Yeah. So the funny thing that will surprise readers is that I show that O'Reilly, the Fox News O'Reilly, was not the O'Reilly before Fox News. If you look at him on Inside Edition, he was stiffer. He was trained as a television news reporter.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked in all these different cities and he was trying to be more like a network news person. Like mm-hmm. that was his aspiration, like Ted Koppel or Brian Williams. Like that was what he thought he wanted to do. And he hit a ceiling. So then he went into tabloid TV with Inside Edition because he was going nowhere. And he watched Mari Povich was his main competition. Mari Povich was unlike any news anchor we'd seen up to that point. He was using his eyebrows. He was mocking his job. He was taking a side in the news story. And so I argue that really it was in that ratings competition that O'Reilly learned things from Povich.
Hmm.
And O'Reilly learned to be expressive. He learned to have that personal voice, to be emotional, to use body language. And so he carried that. And then at Fox News, you know, where a regular network news place would tell you to mute your ethnic white identity, like his Irishness, his mm-hmm. Catholicness, his Long Islandness. He has this accent, right? Regional accent. They would say, mute that, tone that down. But Roger Ailes was like, turn it up, right?
Yep, yep.
So if someone like Shep Smith is from Mississippi, I believe, it has a strong Southern drawl. They said, turn that up. Call yourself Shep, not Shep Shepherd, right? Smith.
Yep.
And so there's these ways. And then he has his own, you know, I mean, he famously said that his show was the only working class news show in America. Right. I start the book with that. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, you know, growing up in Long Island and in Levittown's blue collar background. There's a dispute about his actual class background and all that. But I do think that You're right. Of the three, between Beck, Hannity, and O'Reilly, you know, O'Reilly had a degree at Harvard. It's a business degree there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so he strategically masks his elite elements of his background and plays up the kind of more populist elements. But I do think he was, as a television performer, one of the greatest performers of class that we've seen in a long time. He was very good at what he did. And, you know, and people are like, well, we pick apart his biography. And I go, well, you can pick apart Rocky Balboa and say that's a fictional character, but it still is a very important symbol of working class identity all the same.
Exactly.
So I think liberals get hung up again with this like sociological, scientific.
Right.
They try to attack their enemies and say Donald Trump's a real estate mogul. He's elite. He's rich. You're kind of missing the point, though, how they function in that symbolic space of media and politics. They are the fighter or the proxy for the working class audience.
Right.
And the working class audience knows they're millionaires. You know, they know it's not like they're duped.
Right.
But that's kind of missing the point.
Right. And I knew Rocky Balboa was a fictional character, but I still wanted to drink raw eggs and build my lats. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, these things have real impact. They resonate, yeah. So I want to talk about how the left is kind of, the way the left, or either the mainstream, NBC, CBS, et cetera, but MSNBC, is so different in all these respects. But before that, there's two other elements of Fox I want you to hit on. One you alluded to already is how they bring expert voices in without giving up their critique of elitism and expertise. I know it's complicated, but see if you can explain that briefly. Because they do. You show how that you mentioned the Amity Shales, but they've done that with lots of others. How do they do that and still keep their creds with an audience that they've cultivated misgivings and suspicion about expertise? And then the other piece, if you can remember both of these, is the physical background. And you can then, when you talk about that, talk about how different it is on Fox compared to, say, MSNBC, actually what the viewer sees when they're as the background, the sort of context of that. But let's start with this expertise issue.
Well, so my final chapter, you know, I the reader goes through the book and it's all about populism. This is how they perform working class identity. This is how they're populist, you know, for four chapters. And then at the end, I kind of throw a twist. And I say, but they still have intellectuals on Fox News. They still have experts. They still gesture toward that type of elite authority, but they do it at arm's length in order to like keep the populist blue collar ethos of the host intact, right? There's all these strategies where they try to nullify that potential threat of elitism, right? And I kind of show the dance they do, right? Where they'll have the everyday blue collar host mentioned his parents, right, and lived experience,
right,
like working on construction sites. Like Hannity will bring that up all the time. But then they pivot and then they say the professor or the academic also agrees with the conservative position, but does it in an emotionally detached way, changes the language. So they're not saying, you know, that's outrageous. They're saying that's problematic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they'll have like the language will change. It'll be less moralistic. It'll be less emotional. And it'll focus on facts and research and studies. And so I call this the populist intellectual tactic. I know it's a lot of words, big fancy word, but it's this dance that they do. And it maximizes the argumentative power because you're basically saying, you know, this guy that's closer to me agrees on this conservative position and the intellectual I don't identify with, but I still respect some forms of like that research and that elite knowledge. So it's like almost creates this like consensus, right?
Yeah.
The blue collar conservative guy agrees with it and the conservative intellectual agrees with it. But the point there that I respect about it is they're concerned with keeping that elitism at arm's length where liberals don't even think about it, right?
No,
think like leaning into it
right.
is going to be more important rather than being kind of, maybe you should be aware of the possible downsides of only performing this kind of professional educated style.
I think I recall from the book an example or two where Hannity in particular kind of serves as like a somewhat befuddled interpreter. Like the intellectual is the expert is talking and he's kind of I don't know about shaking his head or rolling his eyes, but he's saying things that sort of show that he doesn't quite follow this egghead himself, but he thinks what they're saying is thus. Is that right?
That's 100% right. Yeah. He'll do things to like make fun of the fact that it's pedantic, right, or it's overly educational. Be like, there's going to be a quiz on that. I hope you got that. Like,
audience.
So it keeps, it like brings academic knowledge down to earth. It makes fun of it. It there's all these strategies. Then they'll use funny graphics to show like a theory of like a conservative intellectual. And so there's all these ways in which they kind of bring academic knowledge down to earth while still gaining authority from it, while still using it to make a conservative argument.
Yes, yes. Okay, so we're almost out of time. So now I want you to pivot and give a kind of a quick view of how the mainstream and or liberal press, particularly TV, but you can bring in print, is in a very different universe in almost all these respects, starting with what you see when you're actually watching the news, the programs.
Yeah, so one thing Murdoch added from print is the like when we think of tabloid print, we think big headlines, we think visceral language, we think graphic images, right? So you can add that to a TV show, and they come up with all these, really Roger Ailes, which is a kind of TV genius behind the Fox News project, is that they innovated the ticker at the bottom of the screen, the icon of Fox News swirling around, the flashy colored sets, you know, the music in between segments. They just added so much more audio and visual style that's hyper stylized. And everyone, you know, in network news and MSNBC and CNN made fun of it. They said this is tacky. It's trashy. It's not good journalism. It gets in the way of the facts. And then they proceeded to copy all those things when they realized it actually brings viewers in. It engages people. But still, you know, Fox, even the types of graphics it'll use. So like on Hannity, when I'm in some of my analysis, I show they're using like mosaic of license plates. That's like very Americana highway. Right. What is it? Highway 66 or whatever. Like they're really aware of like kitsch culture, working class culture, ultra patriotic graphics, which again, liberals make fun of, like Stephen Colbert in his famous parody of Bill O'Reilly, the Stephen Colbert Show. But they're not just critiquing Fox's hyper-nationalism. They're critiquing working class kind of, it's like tacky to be that patriotic, right?
Right.
And they're not realizing that insults working class people, or they're not, they're, like when they think they're making, scoring points from a critical point of view, they don't realize they're reinforcing the system associations where liberals are marked as elite and conservatives are marked as working class and populist.
Right.
So
right,
rather, right. Like when I critique MSNBC and CNN, my critique is that you're doing a lot of the work for the right, right? You basically accept that they are this on the side of the working class and you're on the side of the professional educated viewers, rather than contesting it or throwing a wrench in it or trying to recruit hosts that maybe also have a kind of blue collar populist performative style. So I mentioned the short-lived career of Ed Schultz, who was a successful talk radio, the only liberal that was very successful on talk radio, the top 10 of talk radio shows. He was a former football player, looked like it, right? Big fingers, broad shoulders, and he had union organizers on all the time as guests, right? And they themselves have a working class kind of voice and identity. But eventually MSNBC said, this doesn't fit with our cosmopolitan kind of professional middle-class brand.
Good
we
grief.
Want affluent consumers, we want educated consumers, and this is not in line with our imagination of what liberal MSNBC should look and sound like.
Incredible. And you also mentioned in that same vein, with some differences, Al Sharpton as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, they had Al Sharpton, they had Cenk Uygur, which is the host of the Young Turks.
Right.
You know, Dylan Radigan, they flirted. There was a populist moment with Occupy Wall Street, and it was a post-Tea Party. And there was some acknowledgement that the liberal media needs to counter what Fox did with the Tea Party. But those markets are so locked in conceptually that we liberals cater to professional, educated, affluent news consumers, and the conservative media is more tabloid and more working class.
Right, right.
And it's a big problem.
It is. And so that leads me to the final question. So as with many other things in the realm of politics and culture, I would argue this is kind of why RUBY exists, the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, that generally speaking, the left does not make sustained efforts to broaden its base. As we've redefined ourselves over the last 30, 40 years as the people of the educated folks, the professionals, the credentialed, et cetera, as we've done that and have lost so many ordinary people, working class and others across race, as we've done that, we also have sort of welcomed or celebrated or at least sort of decided, well, that's the way it is for us to be the intelligent and informed. There's no way to reach those other people because of their limitations. And yet all we've done is dig ourselves ever deeper holes in most respects. So the big question for you, if you have some thoughts on this to wrap us up, is what could people on the left, liberals, progressives, even moderates, but people who are concerned about the influence of Fox and other things, what could we do differently going forward to create a media landscape that does welcome working class voices, but also is something of a counter to Fox? Is there any chance of doing that?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to start with being honest and reflective about how our media is not speaking to working class people. I think that's the first thing, because I think there's some denialism where a lot of the existing liberal media likes to think of itself as fighting for little guy because they're like, well, we support, you know, raising the minimum wage, like good pro working class economic policies, and that's enough, right? But if you're speaking a voice and you're using language and your aesthetics, everything is just clearly catering to a narrow audience of more wealthy and educated people, then it's always going to fall flat. No one's ever going to really believe you're fighting for the working class or your show is for working class people. So that's the first thing, right? Mm-hmm. Stop the denialism about who your market really is and right. who you really serve. The second thing is then really be strategic about creating an entire differently class cultural voice and lane in news. Like, how do we create a kind of progressive form of news with a working class style and think imaginatively about talent, people that are already established in our popular culture as kind of symbols or adjacent to working class people, and think about recruiting them, you know, like do what Murdoch and Ailes did. They thought outside the box. They looked at talent in different places. And I think there's a roster of especially younger podcasters and YouTubers, TikTokers that are progressive, that can speak authentically to urban, young urban life, can speak to young rural life, can speak to Gen Z. But, you know, I think we need to feed those existing talent and then coordinate them a lot better. Mm-hmm. Like the ride is so coordinated. That's one thing I always admire about them or jealous about, is that they have such discursive and personnel connections. Like they support, Fox News supports the local talk radio guy, the local talk radio supports Fox News, they're repeating similar narratives. And you just don't see the same cross promotion with like all these kind of independent leftists and progressive media creators. And then the third thing is it would be nice if there were some funders that were conscious of the power of media. I think liberals also downplay, conservatives have a completely media-centric theory of power. I mean, there's no president in history than Donald Trump who believes media power equals political power, right? So they believe that, where I think liberals, they don't want to invest in like a counter Fox News media system because they don't really believe that media has the power that it does. And I don't know how long it'll take liberals to wake up that media is the name of the game. And that is critical to political power. But it would take some funding and it would take an intentional project to do that.
Liberals do think that media has power, but they only think it's on the other side.
Right.
And that willingness to invest for the long term is one of our biggest problems and liabilities, period. Not just in media, but in terms of the intellectual world of think tanks and all of that, in terms of grassroots organizing, in terms of rural outreach, on and on and on. We've tended to go every 2 years, the biggest election of our lives, and then the next biggest election of our lives, and then the next one, and we keep avoiding this long-term kind of thing. Well, Reese, we've got to call 100%. It, because we're a little on the long side. This has been just fantastic. I'm going to absolutely, if you're willing, get you to be a speaker on Ruby's monthly briefing series, which we do the first Wednesday of every month. And I am just thrilled. I want to remind our guests on the podcast that we have been talking to Reese Peck, who is a professor of journalism and political communication and popular culture. He is also the author of a book that you absolutely must read. If you have ever uttered the words that Fox News is the problem, then you must read his book, which is called Fox Populism: Branding Conservatism as Working Class. It's brilliant, and it will surprise the hell out of you. So, Reese, thanks again so much for being on Two Worlds, One Country. Thank you, Anthony.